thing that first got us interested in coming up here was getting into mining.
I'm just testing this now, mm-hmm. so while you're talking, turn her on. Tonight we're in, this is Mike Dalton, and I'm in the home of Frank and Neva Whaley in Fairbanks, Alaska. That's located at 4658 7th Street, and that's in Broadmoor Acres, near Fairbanks International Airport. Frank, I'm going to sit a little closer over here so I can take advantage of this microphone also.
Oh, yeah, good.
You don't mind, do you, Neva?
Well, I'll bear up.
Well, Frank, I heard the Beeline program recently, maybe four weeks ago now, when Larry Carpenter interviewed you, and it really intrigued me to... I was just fascinated by some of the stories that you told, and I'm sure that you've told them before, or you've lived them, and it's probably nothing to you, but I thought they were very fascinating. You've done a lot of different things in your life, you and Neva. Would you when did you come to Alaska? Did you come by yourself, or were you married at the time? Or
Yes, we were married. We lived in Seattle, where my partner and I were operating charter service at Boeing Field from 1929 to 33, and it was Neva and I met in Seattle as members of the Crystal Pool swimming team there, and at the time we were both doing quite a lot of swimming, and we were married in 1931. And, of course, this was right at the period after the 1929 crash, and things were anything but prosperous, and we were having quite a struggle trying to stay in business. And it seemed that about the only cash customers that we could get a hold of were those that came out of Alaska, and... several of those kept impressing on us the opportunities that existed in Alaska at that time, mainly because it was right after the price of gold had been raised from $19 an ounce to $35 an ounce. And this had made it possible to open up some of the old diggings that had been abandoned. And my partner and I decided, well, maybe we should take a couple of these airplanes up there and attempt to get in the mining by using the planes as a method of eating for the period that it would take us to get a hold of some mining property. And this is what really brought us up here. So in the fall of 33, we did shipped planes to one of the planes, the sixth place Traveler, which was quite a modern plane at that time, to Valdez. Bob Reeves was already there. Incidentally, we knew Bob from Seattle. He had been there some prior to coming on up here. And we assembled the plane there. Owen Meals helped us assemble the plane and flew it on into Copper Center and on into Fairbanks.
Was that the first plane in Valdez? Airplane?
Oh no, there had been planes there. Owen Meals had a plane, and Bob had his plane there at the time. There had been quite a little flying.
I knew that Owen, I had talked to Owen Meals one time, and he told me about his mm-hmm. early flying adventures.
He was quite an old timer, and he's still there, and we see him occasionally when we go to Valdez.
Who was your partner? What was his
Harry
name?
Harry Nelson.
And he came with you.
Yes, he came with us. And Neva came with us. We all came up on the boat together.
Neva, do you recall that boat trip?
Well, yes, it's been a long time ago, but it was very exciting to be going to Alaska, because in those days that was just the most far-out place you could go to. It's different now, of course, but we were looking forward expectantly to making our fortune and all the things that you dream about when you're young. So we enjoyed the boat trip very much, and I don't know, you were perhaps going to tell them about your first experience on skis anyhow, when they put the skis on the plane. Why?
Was that at Valdez?
No, we flew on in on wheels to Fairbanks. It was late in the fall, but I remember we overnighted in Copper Center, and it snowed about a good foot that night, and I had never attempted to take off under conditions like that. I was quite concerned whether or not we'd be able to get out, and we got out there and snowshoed the runway and packed it down good, a little strip there that John Cross was there at the time, and he...
John Cross is still living.
Yes.
In Nome, isn't he?
He's living at Kotzebue.
Kotzebue.
John, I think, is 78 years old and still has a commercial pilot's license, still does a little flying with, I think, a Civil Air Patrol plane that he has over there. Quite amazing that he's still able to pass a physical and getting by very well.
Well, this plane that you said you shipped one plane up?
Yeah,
from
we
Seattle?
Sold the other airplanes. We were going to bring up a second and decided to, later to sell it out there, not to bring it up. It was an open cockpit plane, and we could soon determine that it wasn't too suitable up here, particularly any winter flying, for an open cockpit airplane.
So it was a six-place traveler that you brought up.
Yeah, traveler. Had a 300-horsepower motor in it, and rigged up with heaters, and it was quite a wonderful airplane, as I say, for those days. It belonged, that plane, we bought it down on Los Angeles. It belonged to a movie actor, and I can't recall who the name was now.
Wasn't it Tom Mix or something?
One of the early day movie personality owned this plane that we got it from down there. But I recall landing here in Fairbanks, and all the assistance that we got from Joe Crossan, particularly, was one that, and Robinson also helped give me a lot of pointers as to the operation of skis, because there's quite a trick to learning to fly skis where you do not have any brakes to help you stop or help you on your turns. You have to rely on the slipstream blast on the rudder and control surfaces to give you control on in place of brakes that normally you use. We had the skis put on here, and then I made a number of trial runs, shooting landings and perfecting a little of the technique before we took off for Nome. We landed, I think, at Ruby, the first spot, and then on to Nalato, where we waited a couple of days. You might want to tell them a little about what happened to you in Nalato, Neil.
Well, of course, we didn't know much about winter conditions or how to dress. And I remember I had just the very latest in the type of pants that were very form-fitting and that flared out at the sides. That was way back. But they were the most in those days. And a pair of boots and no long underwear, nothing warm, just looked real classy. But wow, when we hit that cold weather... And,
the temperature there was 40 below.
Yeah, Nalato, 40 below.
And real cold overnight.
No winter gear at all. I had a light leather suede jacket that was also very classy in those days. But, it was awful. When you step out in 40 below, you just can't believe what's happened. And I remember old Pop Russell there in the roadhouse. And... he was quite a character, too. I guess a lot of people have a lot of stories about Pop. but he pointed me to the outhouse in the back because I had been in the airplane quite a while. And I went tearing out to the outhouse at 40 below with practically no clothes on at all. And took care of nature's call out there. And these pants that flared at the side were all buttoned also down the side. There must have been 20 buttons on either side. And so when I started to come back in, it was an absolute impossibility to button up my breeches. So I came in and I was crying because I hadn't experienced the pain of being so cold before. It was just terrible. My fingers were freezing up. Well, I was just freezing up. And old Pop Russell, he took me over by the fire and he very carefully buttoned up the 20 buttons on either side for me like I was a little girl. And I never forgot that. That was the first initiation into what we were going to face. And that was a shocker.
Now that was, you were flying from Fairbanks to Nome, and this incident where nature called was at Nulato, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Flying in the plane were you and Frank.
And Harry Nelson,
your partner.
And we had a wire hair fox terrier, a little dog that we brought up with us that turned out to be quite a novelty to the Eskimo people. At that time, they had seen very few in the way of little pet dogs like we have, or many of them in the country now. But he later went with me on a great many flights. In fact, I kept tab of his flying, and it went well over 100,000 miles that he flew with me in the Arctic. And I used to call him my emergency rations on the hoof, but I'm afraid I'd have had to be pretty bad shape before I'd ever tackled him.
What was the dog's name?
His name was Snug, S-N-U-G. And he was quite a guy. He learned many things about flying here in the Arctic. One of them, he turned out to be a real co-pilot in that to get the frost and the snow off the wings before takeoff, I would coil up a rope and throw one end of it up over the wing, and he immediately would grab the end that dropped down over the front end, and then I could stand there and whip up and down this wing and get this rope to whip, and he was just the right weight, so he wouldn't weigh enough to damage the fabric any, and I could tell him when to turn loose, and he'd go over and catch the rope on the other wing, and I used him right along for this, which was one thing that he kind of helped earn his keep. But in cold weather, he learned that he shouldn't at all stay in the slipstream of the propeller. He'd wait until the door was all open and they were all ready for him to get aboard, and he'd just practically jump through the slipstream to get into the plane. And then in the summer, because of the mosquitoes in some areas where they are exceptionally bad, one of them used to be Pilgrim Hot Springs north of Nome, and man, the mosquitoes were really something there in the summer. And there he wouldn't get out of the slipstream. We actually, in many places, would keep the propellers turning. He wouldn't shut the engine off to avoid the airplane cabin loading up with mosquitoes. They were so bad that they would get in there, and it would take you a half hour to clean up the inside of the windows and the windshield before you could take off. But he is used to pop out of the airplane when I'd land at these native villages where they'd never seen a dog of that type, and they'd really stand back and some of them take off because they thought it was something other than a dog. I remember one time at Golovin, first time we was in there, and the wire hair jumped out, and particularly the kids and a few grown-ups all took off a ways, and I kept trying to convince him that he was a dog, and they, oh no, he's not a dog, they wouldn't go for that. And finally the wire hair went over and lifted his legs and wet down one of the wheels of the plane. Oh yes, he dog all right. That convinced him that he was a dog.
So that was in the fall of 1933 that you arrived in Nome.
Mm-hmm.
Was Nome expecting you? Was there a welcoming committee?
Well, hardly.
No.
In those days, the competition was very, very keen for what little business there was to be had, and the competition wasn't too hot about us stepping in. It would just delete whatever was there that much more, and so there was no aid or assistance to speak of there. I remember there was no snow. It was not sufficient snow in Nome to land on the airfield. It was partly bare. The wind had blown the snow off. And we flew around a while before I could dope out what looked like it might be a suitable landing area, and finally went down to the mouth of Nome River. And that was the first experience I'd ever had landing on glare ice. The wind had whipped all the snow off the ice. And this is also a very tricky, getting your plane under control after a landing on glare ice. First off, it takes up a great deal of space without much of any drag to the skis. Finally, we did get one or two fellows came out there to help us taxi in and to a place where we could turn it tie down. But there's been a long, hard pull of learning the hard ways how to handle your airplane under all the various conditions. As we stayed there, of course, and came better acquainted, we did get a lot of help from a lot of people and started flying. This was in late in the fall, and started flying within the first few days, started making some trips. And our maps in those days were very, very sparse and very scarce. I remember the thing for some time, the best map that we could get a hold of was a Lohmann Commercial Company Caterpillar tractor road-type map with no elevations marked on it, large areas marked unsurveyed, believed to be over 4,000 feet high or whatever the elevation might be. But we didn't have anything much in the way to aids to navigation, and weather reports were very, very sparse. They might get one a day, or rather one during all day from Kotzebue was about the only weather that we got.
How would you get the weather report? Did you have radio?
They had reports. We did not have them in the aircraft. We did not have any communications in the planes, but there was a...
But between Kotzebue and Nome?
Yeah, there was a weather observer in Kotzebue, and they would telegraph this information to the weather observer in Nome.
But when you left Seattle, your intent was to go to the Nome area to mine.
Yeah, well, to go there, to base out of there. We were very much in a situation where we had to earn our way as we went along, and we didn't have any sufficient funds to carry on without getting some money coming in from the airplane, so we immediately had to put it to work. And I started getting all information I could as the winter and spring developed about mining properties that might have some prospects. I think that it was the winter, that same first winter, that I had a charter trip with MGM, had made a movie in at Point Hope, and I think they had Ebrulic Rock, I guess his brother to Howard Rock, had been out to Hollywood to provide some sound or Eskimo voice in connection with this movie that they had done there the prior year and the prior spring, and this was to take him back up to his home port. And a fellow, his name is Billy Graham, when he met
No, not Billy Graham.
Wasn't it?
Well, I guess it was.
Yeah. Billy Graham was his name.
Well, I was thinking of the evangelist, yeah. But I guess his name was Billy Graham.
His pilot was named Billy Graham.
Yeah.
And he was not flying. His airplane was out of commission, so he volunteered to go along with me to help show me the way up there to Point Hope, which is on a couple hundred miles north of the Arctic Circle. And we had this Brulic Rock and some mail and one other passenger heading for Point Hope. And we arrived, this was the 29th of December, I remember the flight, the very end of the year, and practically no light because it was the darkness period.
Yes.
We landed all right on a beach there. But on the takeoff the following morning, I hit a whale bone that was frozen in, the jawbone of a whale that was frozen in to the beach, and broke the axle on the ski. And my reaction was, well, I better try to fly this thing on into at least to Kotzebue because there's no facilities to fix it up here. And I tried to keep it in the air and did for maybe 30, 40 seconds, but this ski started whipping in and hitting the fuselage of the plane and then swing back out, hit the struts on the wing, and I could tell it was going to tear the airplane apart if I didn't set it down, so I made a landing on one ski the best that I could for a ways until the speed died out, and then the plane spun over and the axle dug into the snow and spun around and tore up one wing and the tail group pretty well. And
so that was your entrance to Point Hope.
This was really learning about the Arctic phase of it, and the result, I stayed up there a total of 52 days before I get out of there. 21 days, Diva didn't even know where I was. There was no communication. All she knew was that I was missing because I was due back earlier. No way of getting any word through what had happened. So this gave us a kind of a rough takeoff. My partner, Harry Nelson, came up with welding equipment when I did succeed in getting word back out finally what had happened. And we built a hangar out of snow blocks adjacent to a warehouse at the Point Hope School, and got a hold of a few boards and put canvas over the top of it. But for the sides and ends, we used snow blocks about 1 foot thick and stacked them up. And inside of there, we had to rebuild that plane. Well, when you go to dope the airplane, you got to get the temperature warmed up to 65 to 70 degrees to get the dope to adhere properly to the fabric. Every time we did this, the snow block outer perimeter would start to dissolve, and we had to replace some sections of that, and it was quite an experience getting that thing rebuilt so that we could get it in shape to fly back into Nome.
So your first trip was part of a day up and 52 days back. Well, Neva, when you got to Nome, did you set about looking for a home to live in, or did you have a place to stay when you arrived?
Well, they found a place that was that they were going to use for an office, and it had a lot of space upstairs for storing airplane parts and everything that they needed. And we managed to scrounge a place downstairs where we stayed, sort of an office apartment that we fixed up. And well, people were so very, very friendly in Nome, and we had such wonderful friends that we learned to appreciate right from the very beginning. And everybody was very helpful. And anyhow, we got a bed to sleep on and a place to do a little cooking, so we made out all right at that time until later on. Then we got into a home.
Well, by this time, did you learn about winter gear? Were you still wearing your 20-button breeches, or were you
well, after
wearing
we,
something more practical?
After we came into Nome, the ride from Cape Nome, where we had landed, or Nome River, was quite a long ways, and the vehicle that they had sent out for us, I think there was a vehicle that came out, there was still no protection from the cold, and by the time we got into Nome, I was about as in bad shape as I was in Nolato, and I was so cold I could hardly walk, and again, there was an old-timer there that I can't even remember his name now. He was standing out there, and I guess he could tell at a glance what was happening. And he had he was a real old-timer, the kind that live in a little place and they don't have a bath till the following spring or something like that. But this parka that he put on that was moth-eaten, and it was in pretty bad shape, mostly pretty smelly. I was never so glad to get anything on as that. And bless his heart, he put that over me, and then I went upstairs where we could get warm. But I always remember that parka with great fondness and his act. But everybody in Nome was just wonderful and very helpful.
We then used, as I say, the airplane. The spring came on and the miners started coming back into the country, and I did quite a lot of flying, taking them out to their various claims, and again was trying to acquire all the information we could on where there might be likely prospects, and we did become involved to some extent on a prospect, and kind of helped grub-stake an old-timer and took him over in the Anoko Flats out of Caltag a ways, and took he in a small boiler and looked after him for a while that spring while he sunk some prospect holes that never showed up anything. But it was in the winter of 35, I was flying his travel air between Nome and Kotzebue, and got out about 90 miles north of Nome, and the engine, one cylinder, evidently a valve, went down through the piston and right on into the guts of the engine, and just literally tore that motor apart in a few seconds in the air. I had to reach over and cut the switch real quick to keep it from vibrating to the point of where it would tear it off the plane. And I was up at about 5,000 foot elevation, was on top of a fairly heavy ground fog with just an occasional hole that I could see the ground down through there. I have always avoided flying over this type of thing, a solid overcast with a single engine airplane, unless I could see that there was a chance to get to a hole somewhere, and luckily I had this hole spotted. I made a 180 degree turn when this happened and headed back to this little opening where I could see the outline of a little lake, and was able to plunk the plane down. I had no control about selecting or lining up with the wind or anything else. I think I landed crosswind and over some very big drifts that it's amazing that it didn't tear the skis off the plane because it drifted very hard. But while we were right out in the middle of nowhere with no communication, I had a fellow Sidney Rude, I think, was with me, a reindeer supervisor in the area at the time, and two school teachers that were headed for Kotzebue. And I remember they had gotten a hold or brought in with them some bananas that they had gotten from, apparently from Fairbanks, and was going to try to get them on through to Kotzebue up there, taking them up to some friends. So that was their first concern, about hurry up and eating those bananas before they froze up. As the temperature was about 20 below, this was in March, and the wind was blowing. My first concern was getting that airplane tied down so it wouldn't blow away in the event that the winds really kick up, which they do very readily over there. We finally got it, dug a hole down in the ice and made an ice bridge to tie to on either wing and then and one on the tail. And then we could see not very far, a mile or so maybe, around the perimeter of this lake. There was no brush or no willows or nothing there, right out in the middle of nowhere. I knew pretty well where I was because I had been on course. We knew that we were going to have to spend some time there, so I carried with me a saw, coarse tooth saw, kind of like a heavy rip saw, and we cut snow blocks and built a little shelter underneath the wing, using the top of the wing as the top of the igloo, but the snow blocks all around the edge of it. I had found before that these are much warmer than trying to stay in the airplane. The airplane is just that light fabric. The only thing protecting you from the wind outside is extremely cold. You're much better off in a snow block shelter. And I had a little fire pot. We used to use a regular plumber's fire pot, and had a little smokestack and an elbow rig up with it so that I could kick this foul air that the fire pot would put out, stick that out to the side, and rigged up a place to vent that so it wouldn't drive you out of it. And we lived in this primarily. It was there 3 days. Finally, the procedure in those days was that if you did not return to your base of operations, if you had said you would be back, if you were going out on a trip and was going to come back that same afternoon, assuming that you had sufficient light, why, they would wait till you had 3 days of favorable weather before they would consider that you were missing, because they'd assume that you might have run into a charter flight out there, some other work to do. But they'd wait till 3 days of good weather was up, and then if you didn't show, they would send someone looking for you. This was the standing rules of the road at the time. So on the third day, Neva, I think, lined up, and my partner, Nelson, I think it was Chester Brown, Chet Brown in a Balanca. He came over, spotted the airplane, looking for us on the course, and spotted us down there, and came in, landed not too far from where we were, and we got together and explained to him what had happened. I think he took the passengers with him. I think he was going on to Kotzebue. He took them on with him, and then I waited there at the plane a couple of days. My partner in another plane brought out necessary parts and four-by-fours. We had to rig up a tripod over this engine and with block and tackle and lift the engine out and